call the hearing in order. It's day 8 of the hearings on the Upper Clutha. We are without Commissioner McLeod today because he has a personal conflict both with the submitters we will hear and the issues they're raising. So I'm accompanied by Commissioner Munro to my left and Commissioner Hudson to my right. Mr. Page, you have the floor for, I'm standing here for Verena Proprietary Limited.
We are, yes, good morning. My name is Phil Page, I'm the solicitor for Verena. To my right, or to your left, is Ian Greaves, who is going to give planning evidence. Andy Carr to my left, who is going to give traffic evidence. And Jill Corson, even further left, who is going to give urban design evidence. Now, we have filed our evidence and submissions in advance. My submissions were filed on Friday afternoon. I don't know whether you had the opportunity to see them. I have them in hard copy with me and can take you through them. Or if you have them electronically and prefer to keep it that way, then I would ask about that.
I'll just check the other submissions. Questions you read?
Yep. Bills.
I've had a quick glance.
I can't say
I'm fully absorbed.
Perhaps I just
take you through. I think the message, therefore, is that you need more rather than less as you take us through your submissions. I'm familiar with them, but Commissioner Hudson will need your assistance.
Jolly. Now, Commissioner Hudson, do you have it? Would you want to prefer a hard copy? So then I shall kick off. Most of our evidence today is concerning the what is called Site 1, which is the block adjacent to the Wanaka Town Centre on Branston Street. Block 2 in the evidence is the is further along of Branston Street adjacent to the camping ground. And our understanding from the officer's reports is that the medium density residential zoning from that for that site too is not contentious between the submitter and the officers. As a, consequently, it's the town centre overlay zoning, which is the main focus of our attention this morning.
Mr. Page, one question in that regard, since you're not going to deal with it in detail. I've taken note of Mr. Greaves. Is it Greaves or Graves?
Greaves.
Greaves. Thank you. Comment that because of the indication in the staff report regarding the VA zone, that he doesn't focus on it. Has Verena formally withdrawn that aspect of his submission, or do we still need to make a decision on it?
No, Verena has not formally withdrawn that aspect of its submission. For the simple pragmatic reason is we've got no idea what might happen with it. Perhaps I'll address you briefly on that.
Can you do that, Chris?
When the plan was notified, visitor accommodation was part of the notified plan, how the plan proposed to deal with that. It was then submissions were lodged, and Verena sought visitor accommodation subzoning on that site too. Then subsequently the council withdrew the VA aspects, as it's entitled to do, under the first schedule, from the stage one part of the plan. And so we are left with the slightly uncomfortable situation that the plan provisions had gone that we were submitting on, but nevertheless, in my submission, that does not automatically confine the scope of the submission that we lodged. So we are left, I think, with the jurisdictional issue, which is that you have sufficient scope to grant the relief that Verena seeks. But if you were to do that, then that might have wider implications for the district plan because the VA provisions and the rest of the plan have gone. Now, the reason why we simply haven't withdrawn the VA part of the submission is because it strikes us that you may decide that if there are sufficient other submissions on VA, or that Marinus is sufficient in itself, that you have the jurisdiction to say, yes, you can have a VA overlay for your site and reintroduce those to the plan by submissions. I think you've got the power to do that.
The good news is that council agrees with you that it's not a jurisdictional scope issue. It's a question of what outcome best achieves the objectives of the plan.
Yes. Yes, and so in relation to Site 2, the vast majority of that site is already used for visitor accommodation pursuant to resource consents. And of course it's adjacent to the camping ground. So if you were to take the view that the visitor accommodation use of that whole block is sought by Verena best achieves the objectives of the plan, then you can do that. I guess what Mr. Greaves was doing was recognising that the council at this point in time has signalled that it proposes to deal with VA in part two of the plan, and so we looks like we're going to be back to talk about that on another day anyway. But I'm not conceding for a moment that you can't and shouldn't deal with it under this solution for the foresight too.
Can I make a practical point that in the absence of planning evidence supporting the point, we may be in difficulty concluding on section 32 basis that the VA zone of that property of that block is the most appropriate way to achieve the objectives?
Yes, well, that's a merits point. And so I'm simply making the jurisdictional point that you can do that if you come to the view that that is the most appropriate way to achieve the objectives.
Well, as long as we understand each other, then that's fine. Please carry on.
Thank you. So I, in preparing these submissions, I had read the open legal submissions of counsel for the council. And for the most part I agree with them, but I had drawn two inferences from those submissions which my submission are not correct, and those lie at paragraphs 216 and 217 of the Council for Council submissions. And the first one is that submitters bear an onus to prove that the zone provisions sought are more appropriate than the notified zone provisions. To the contrary, the long-held legal position is that there is no presumption in favour of the notified plan, nor is there a notice of proof on a submitter. And that goes back as far as Green and McCarthy.
Mr. Page, I don't have an issue with the first point, but what Green and McCarthy, what Justice Salmon said, is that there is no formal onus of proof.
Yes.
Is there an informal onus of proof on a he or she who asserts must prove basis?
No, I wouldn't call it that. Justice Salmon described your role as inquisitorial, which is to say that you are required to evaluate whatever's put up and decide which best serves, I suppose, in the post-King Salmon world, the objectives of the plan. So if a submitter fails to call adequate evidence to show that their relief sought is more appropriate than another form of relief sought, then there is a danger that that submission might be accepted. Whether that's materially different to what you were just putting to me a moment ago, I'm not really sure.
I'm not sure it is, because in our complex Section 32 matrix, the concept that the case of the council for the existing zoning and your case for a different zone are actually entirely on par.
Yes.
Is pretty remote.
Yes. Yeah, but what?
So as to make the question of who bears an onus,
yes,
relevant to the ultimate determination.
Yes, but what I had inferred from paragraph 216 of the council submissions is that the notified provisions are what they are, and it's up to the submitter to dislodge those. My submission to you is that's not a correct statement of the law, if that was what was intended to be conveyed.
Well, I think the message is that I don't have any difficulty with the proposition you put into it.
Okay, thank you. Now, the second proposition which I took issue with is in the paragraph that followed at 217, where it was said it was not appropriate to rely on matters for discretion or control reserved in zone provisions and exercised at the time of resource consents to assess adverse effects. And it was said that that proposition derived from colonial vineyards. I've been unable to find that proposition in the colonial vineyards case. Section 32.1c, which is relied on at paragraph 217, deals with a different task, namely requiring a level of detail corresponding with the anticipated effects of implementing a proposal. It is admitted that assessing the likely effectiveness of provisions in a plan and achieving the objectives is inherent in section 32.1b2. Care needs to be taken not to turn plan submissions into quasi-resource consent applications. Section 32 does not require an evaluation of any particular use of land per se, but rather whether a provision is effective in achieving a plan's objectives in relation to land uses. Section 32.1c needs to be understood in that light.
Mr. Page, we had an extensive discussion last week with Mr. Withnell QC on a related point, and it doesn't have a specific focus on that discussion. It was about infrastructure, whether it needs to be available, which is a chicken and egg. That was one item of discussion. And the other item of discussion was his particular relief raised landscape issues, and the question was if it were rezoned, did the zone that he was seeking provide a route to achieve an acceptable landscape outcome? And the proposition that I put to him that I think he agreed with was that we have to see a different zone providing a route to an outcome which is consistent with the objectives, the strategic objectives, and referencing back to ultimately part two, that whether that actually occurs is a matter for a future consent process, but there has to be a route that
yes.
We can have confidence in. And so I want to test whether you would agree with that proposition.
Yes, I do agree with that proposition, because that concerns whether the methods are likely to be efficient or effective in achieving objectives, and that's squarely what section 32.1b is about. But what I had understood, and perhaps I have misunderstood the council to be saying, is that it's not appropriate to simply say, oh, those methods will deal with adverse effects issues later, so we don't have to deal with them now. And that it was critical of that approach. And I'm saying, well, that's exactly what district planning processes are for. You are assessing the effectiveness of methods, not whether a particular outcome will be achieved. And I suspect from what you were telling me a moment ago that was the proposition that you were putting to Mr. Withnell.
Yes. But we can't prejudge
yes.
what the effect of application
yes.
Of a particular set of zoning provisions will be, but we need to be comfortable, satisfied on the evidence
yes.
that those, in effect, the zone sort provides all the tools necessary to produce an acceptable outcome.
Yes, if a resource consent is going to be triggered by an activity, what's the framework for that resource consent to be decided by, and as you say, are the tools there?
And again, to complete the circle, the discussion I had with Mr. Whitman was on a conditional basis, because one of the things that's a matter of flux is the default activity status for subdivisions, because as notified in residential zones and rural lifestyle and rural residential zones, it's discretionary. A very large number of submitters sought to be controlled. The council staff in the subdivision hearing recommended that it be restricted discretionary, and that panel, of which I happen to be a member, is still mulling that one over. So yeah. That there are, well, I think given that the council had resiled from fully discretionary, that's an unlikely outcome, but it could be controlled, because there are a very large number of submitters who sought that.
Yes.
And that has implications for a rezoning application, of course. If it's controlled, then I think Mr. Withwell accepted that there's a bigger hurdle at the gate satisfying the panel that a rezoning application or the new zone will actually be able to produce an acceptable outcome. And the greater the level of discretion at the second stage, perhaps the lower the hurdle at the initial stage might be.
I think that's a sound proposition in terms of the relative hurdles that are faced. Of course, with control, is it conceivable that you might have to decline a consent in order to achieve the relevant objectives and policies, which seems to be the threshold and question to be answered about that. I'm not sure we'll worry too much about that today.
Well, I think you might be in a happy state of not being worried about subdivisions, but more about the detail of the rules.
Yes.
Of the other rules.
Yes, that's right. And so, in fact, if I move to my paragraph 3, there doesn't seem to be an awful lot conceptually between the reporting officers and Verena. Both parties seem to agree that a high-quality urban environment with commercial activity on both sides of Brownston Street is the common goal here. And of course, the council does not agree that Russell Street should be included, because they say it's different to Brownston Street. And that might be a discussion to have with the witnesses as we go. The council sees no functional need to extend the town centre zone in terms of floor space demand, although it accepts that the current uses of the submission site are already largely commercial, and that this is provided for in the MDR-TCTO overlay anyway. The council doesn't agree that the MDR-TCTO provisions will result in a built form that is inefficient for commercial activities or result in a suboptimal urban design outcome. Fundamentally, there is substantial agreement between the witnesses about what the goal is. The submission site is to serve the town centre's southernmost margin and should make provision for commercial activities. But the witnesses do not agree on whether MDR-TCTO provisions are the most appropriate way to define that margin. At the core of the difference of opinion is whether the rules should enable buildings on the road frontage that are up to 3 storeys tall, that's the WTCTO provisions, or should they be set back 3 metres from the road frontage with a maximum 7 metres building height and a maximum 45% site coverage, which is the MDR provisions. Ms. Jones, in her rebuttal, points out that the competing provisions both have buildings as discretionary restricted activities subject to identical sweep of design-related matters. The question I put to you then is, if the same design outcome is anticipated, then it seems very odd that the zone standards, like the setback, building height, site coverage and parking, that leads to that result are different. Surely then, a different result is intended in the MDR zone or the Waikato Town Centre zone. It is admitted that if Ms. Corson and Mr. Greaves' evidence is accepted, then the relevant policy framework points toward Verena's relief being favoured. That is because the town centre standards are purpose designed to support efficient utilisation of town centre land and meet the needs of commercial activities. The medium density residential standards are not designed for that purpose. Commercial activities are therefore more likely to be more economically sustainable and therefore more vibrant within built form that is designed for their express purpose under the Waikato Town Centre provisions. A schedule of relevant provisions of the NPS UDC and the objectives and policies of the proposed plan pointing to an urban form consistent with Verena's submission is appended to these submissions. It is submitted that the weight of those provisions favours the transitional overlay sitting within the Waikato Town Centre Zone provisions and adopting that zone standards. Finally, there is an interesting practical problem arising from the position being defended by the reporting officers. Most of the buildings on the south side of the road are nearing the end of their economically useful lives. I'm sure you've been down there in recent times. We're talking about mostly 1960s, 1970s vintage residential form. Suppose Verena builds new buildings now in accordance with the standards in the MDR TCTO rules. And by that I mean set back from the road frontage with car parking 45% site coverage 7 metres high. Then in 10 or even 20 years' time, the site is zoned Waikato Town Centre because the town centre growth has already overtaken the site or more commercial space is required. What happens then? To achieve the no road setback design outcome that the Waikato Town Centre road provisions require, does Verena then demolish new or 10-year-old buildings and replace them with new ones? Of course not. On the basis of the Building Act, these buildings have a life of at least 50 years. So Waikato is then left for the next 50 years with a built form that does not accord with what the council wants the Waikato Town Centre to look like. What this tells us is that the future integration of the staff's proposed MDR TCTO commercial buildings into the Waikato Town Centre is a real practical issue that should be resolved now. The way to fix that problem is for the TCTO overlay to sit within the Waikato Town Centre zone provisions. And if I could pause here now to observe something fundamental about plans and planning, what we are concerned with here in a planning exercise is not to describe the environment as it is now and to wrap provisions around that, but what the fundamental task is planning for land use change. It's an anticipatory process. And we can see that clearly in this case because we are dealing with a transition overlay. So what are we transitioning from and to? We are transitioning from residential use off the south side of Branston Street, although that's mostly happened, to commercial use of that space in association with the town centre. So given that the goal is to facilitate and manage that transition from residential to commercial, it does seem strange in my submission that the transition overlay provisions sit in a residential zone, which is what we're going from, instead of the Waikato Town Centre zone, which is what we are going to. And so that's the kind of the fundamental difference between the parties here, I think, is that Verena says, let's confront where we are going and plan for that, and not be concerned so much about where we've come from, which is
the residential zone.
Can I put a proposition to you, Mr. Page? And that is that maybe the transition you're talking about is what you see, the intended transition is what you see here and now, mostly what you see here and now, namely residences that have been converted to commercial activities, and that your case rather is that Ms. Corson's case in particular is that council should have a different vision.
I think Verena's case is more, I mean, there are aspects in what you say, and Ms. Corson takes an urban design approach to whether it's desirable to see symmetry across Brownsmith Street. But I think Verena's case has another angle to it as well, which is to say, if you accept that commercial use of the south side of Brownsmith Street is appropriate, then given we are required to have regard to the efficient utilisation of resources, is it efficient to require the use of that south side of Brownsmith Street by commercial activity within residential built form? Or is it a better expression of the objectives of the plan in Section 7 of the Act to enable that land to be used by commercial activities in a commercial built form? Because that's more efficient. Site coverage is better. We're built to the street frontage. And we're not required to provide all of our own on-site car park, which is really the issue that Mr. Carr is going to address. So there is a vision issue, as you say. But in my submission, when you look back at the provisions of the plan which require vibrancy and the functioning of Wanaka Town Centre as the core commercial precinct in the Upper Clutha, it drives you, in my submission, to a view that we should be using that land as efficiently as possible. In Green's case, is that the MDR standards for buildings don't get us there.
Bouncing off that page, is there an element of circularity in your logic that if you define the town centre as ending in the middle of Brownsmith Street, the vibrancy of the southern side is not an issue in terms of policy, whereas if you define the town centre as you are seeking, your client is seeking, to include halfway into the next block, then those policies come into play.
I don't think the proposition is quite as stark as that, because the moment that you recognise that the site is part of a town centre transition, as the notified plan does, then the vibrancy of the town centre does become an issue. We're not dealing with a form of deferred zoning here. The common ground position seems to be that the site is in a town centre transition environment. All we're talking about is whether the right camp for that transition is in the MDR zone provisions or in the Wanaka Town Centre zone provisions?
And lastly, I should get clear in my mind that, lastly for me, that your relief is to, like, you know, Sneaky Curlew, who's going to follow you, has a different take. But your relief is to push the town centre to the mid-block. Have I got that right?
Yes.
Yep, so a couple of things, Ms. Page. First one, I just want to understand the submitter's view on the extent to which the various legs in the relief being sought can be decoupled from one another. Long story short, if we were to come to the point where we agreed with the logic of a change of zone on the land to town centre zone, but we weren't convinced about the additional rules and provisions of the overlay and recommended to the council that it just rezoned the land, maybe with a building restriction area or area restriction along the back to get whatever setbacks required, but not support the overlay provisions, where would you plan to sit on that?
Well, the proposition that you put certainly within scope, no. So we don't have that problem. Fundamentally, the concern that our clients have is that in the future, in the very near future, they're going to have to think carefully about how they redevelop their property. And fundamentally, their concern is to ensure that that is done using an efficient built form that is able to directly address the street boundary and be suitable for sustainable commercial activities. If that can be achieved, then precisely how we dress that up is of no moment.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's helpful for me anyway. There's no point us pursuing re-hearings if you like. That
sure.
Wouldn't be realistic. Onto the more substantive question from my part. Having read all the evidence, I didn't read the provisions sought through Mr. Greaves' evidence in the same way Mr. Carr, Ms. Banks, Ms. Jones have. Specifically, there seems to be a view from those experts that effectively there wouldn't be a parking requirement if we were to support the outcome sought, whereas I read Mr. Greaves' evidence clearly as saying the provisions would require a parking solution on a case-by-case basis.
Mm-hmm.
It might be none, it might be some, it might even be more than just having a set number in plan, might be. So I want to understand what's being sought.
Well, and that's a topic that we discussed before we arrived in here this morning. And we think that the issue is largely a commercial one, which is to say that if you have a business that needs to attract customers and your customers cannot get there, then that is a recipe for failure. So it is likely that there will be car parking of some kind for some of the businesses. What we say is that it is more likely that it is, the optimum outcome will be achieved by that parking being accessible to the rear of commercial premises than parking along the frontage. The reason why we haven't promoted a suite of rules requiring access along the rear of the properties is because at the present time that ownership is reasonably fragmented, as Ms. Jones has pointed out, and so we're not sure that that rule suite would work at a practical level. So that's why we think that absent of a specific car parking requirement in design provisions, that's a solution that can be worked out on a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
So what I think you said was that you agree with me that the relief source doesn't make parking some nil or never a permitted activity. It's effectively part of the restricted discretionary activity.
It would be, yeah. And remembering, of course, we've got the transportation section to cover around too.
Yes, so, so I just want to understand the difference between apples and oranges.
Right.
So the relief being sought is that parking doesn't have, it doesn't start with a number, but it's restricted discretionary activity to figure out.
Yes.
The current OVP approach to parking is that there is a number,
yes,
but someone who doesn't like that number can just apply for a resource consent process to figure something else out.
Yeah.
And who knows whether when that transport section comes around, that becomes a restricted discretionary activity or a discretionary activity or non-compliant.
Yes.
We don't know that. But is it fair to say that between the option that's being promoted and the likely alternative, whether there's a number or not, you're volunteering the resource consent in every instance as a discretionary activity? Whereas the other option of having a number is that if you meet the number, you might not need consent for that. But otherwise, if you don't like the number, you just go and apply for a consent for that. Is that what's wrong with this?
I think what you're saying is fair, but can I, what you're sort of getting to, I think, is coming to the nub of the case, and let me show you the Armageddon scenario that we are anxious to avoid, and we can find that in Ms. Corson's evidence on page, the cross-section where she showed. It's produced from the anger on page 16.
Yeah.
And this is, it's figure 4 on page 16.
Yeah.
And this is derived from the Wanaka Town Centre Character Guideline 2011. And what you can see is a cross section showing Brownson Street, and you've got on the right hand side the Wanaka Town Centre Zone, and on the left hand side we've got MDR. And what you can see is that there is a fence with a 3 metre setback to a residential, so it says, building. Now, in Vereen's submission, inevitably the ground floor of that building will be commercial, because that is the highest and best use of that frontage. And inevitably that space between the fence and the building will be car park, because there is no other commercial use of that space other than to fill it up with cars, which will be reversing on and off Brownston Street to access that car parking. And that is a truly appalling urban design outcome in the advice of Ms. Corson to Verena, and it is what we are trying to avoid.
Yep, I understand that. What I'm not clear on is how, in the absence of rules that require alternative access and a concession, that through a restricted discretionary consent being offered, an even higher parking requirement might be identified than just having the council's default number. I'm struggling to see how the relief sort will assure the outcome your expert witnesses have concluded it would, when it seems to me it might, but it might end up with precisely the same number of vehicle crossings along those different fragmented landowners, the same if not more car parking requirement, because the town centre zone provides more floor space on each side than the median view of the overlay, and more floor space normally results in more traffic generation. So what I'm looking for is something that will actually guarantee the great outcomes that are being promoted, not just let them happen, but actually not necessarily stop any of the outcomes that are being told to stop.
Well, the thing about the Wanaka Town Centre Zone provisions is that I can't point you to the right provision, and you probably will be able to, is that part of being in the Wanaka Town Centre Zone is the provision for communal car parking spaces around the periphery of the Wanaka Town Centre to serve the Wanaka Town Centre's needs. So it's not necessarily, and each business has to provide its own car parking, they are not prevented from doing so, but the policy framework doesn't anticipate that they necessarily will be required to. And so that's the same approach that we favour here, which is that a landowner can choose to provide on-site car parking if they wish to, but should not be expected that it will necessarily provide on-site for all their car parking needs, which is not the assumption that applies in the MDR plans.
Unless, and apples again, apples with apples, apples with oranges, your relief is based on a restricted discretionary resource consent process to figure out. So that's not too dissimilar from somebody in the medium density alternative volunteering to go down a resource consent process to get to the same point.
No, that is true, but those resource consents aren't decided in a vacuum, and it's the policy framework which is worrying us.
If we came to the position where we were so enamoured by the outcomes described by your witnesses that we felt that everything should be supported with rules requiring rear lane type access.
Yeah.
Where does that land us?
There would need to be a transitional mechanism which enabled the land passes to be developed in advance of that lane necessarily becoming available. It's Verena's vision that it wants to get to that point, but in the absence of willing buyers and willing sellers cooperating, and that can't be controlled by the plan provisions.
Would the inclusion of an overlay as a method be an opportunity to identify, for instance, a rear lane? That, notwithstanding the timing question, and notwithstanding just a rule that says there should be some form of whatever, would that be a means to provide landowners with a greater certainty that, putting aside the timing issue, everybody had to be part of that integrated solution?
Yes, yes it would. And we've gone some way down that line of thinking by increasing the setback from the rear boundary, which serves two functions. It acknowledges the increased building height that we're seeking, but it also provides sufficient width for a rear lane to be constructed within that setback, and that's part of the way that's intended.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Commissioner
Hudson?
Good morning, Mr. Page. Just following up from Commissioner Munro's question, in terms of the practical realities of the commercial development, quite often developments are conceived and go through a council consent process without the final tenancies being known. And I think it's generally understood that there can be quite a significant variation in parking demand from one tenancy to another. And the kind of example that comes to mind is perhaps a restaurant versus another form of retail. And even real estate agents have a renowned demand for parking space. So I'm just wondering how your proposed methodology associated with the provisions you're seeking would deal with that in a practical sense, in terms of reliance on a restricted discretionary process to assess parking demand. We actually might not know what parking demand is going to be.
Well, that would call into question the adequacy of resource consent application that's been made, I suppose. If, as part of that consent application, car parking is a matter for council's discretion, and council was left with...
I hope you could hear me.
Well, I could. I don't know whether anybody else can.
Not captured for posterity.
Looks like I can ask whatever I like now.
I wonder if this page, in the unlikely event that somebody will listen to our words of wisdom, or Commissioner Hudson's words of wisdom, you could incorporate in your answer the Commissioner's question.
Yes. Well, as I understand the question, you're asking me whether in the provisions which are proposed by Verena, we will necessarily know at the time of the resource consent application what the car parking demand of each tenancy is likely to be, and how the provisions will respond to that. And my answer to that is that inevitably when a resource consent application is sought and one of the maths for discretion is car parking, some assessment and assumptions will have to be made, otherwise you're going to get Section 92 to death. And so I don't think at a practical level that's likely to be a big impediment. And part of the benefit of the Wanaka Town Centre policy framework is the idea that shared municipal provided car parking facilities is an acceptable method of dealing with some of the car parking demand in any case.
Can you just clarify for me what the council's policy is right now in relation to providing communal parking? Is there a special rating scheme for the town centre?
I have no idea how it's funded. I mean, I'm aware that the commercial properties are rated on the basis of facilities provided. Whether they are directly funding car parking on council land, I simply don't know. In terms of what the council's policy is around the provision of car parking, that would be a question better addressed to Andy.
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Page. That's
it. In terms of the practical dimension, the redevelopment that you're talking about and the rules that occurs under, I wonder whether the horse has already bolted since I having going past it at least twice a day. I notice that Commissioner McLeod Cinema is in the process of being extended.
Yes.
On its existing floor plate. So
yes.
As I say, is it? And that's a marina site. So as I say, in terms of the practical dimension, has the horse already bolted?
No. I mean, that's not Verena's only land holding. And neither do I. Well, I'm not aware that what is being constructed now is necessarily the complete built out end game view of the site that Verena has. So, although, yes, there is building activity going on, which would reflect the bulk and location requirements of the MDR zone, I wouldn't have thought that Verena's view would be that that's the end of the matter. It is simply the next phase.
Yes, I deliberately didn't ask Commissioner McLeod what he was doing for that very reason. Just for clarification, you said that's not Verena's only land. How much of the block does Verena own?
It's shown in the attachment to Ms. Jones's evidence.
Yes, I remember that. I just couldn't remember what it showed. I thought I'd take a shortcut.
Yeah, so there is another parcel to next door to the cinema, and there is a further parcel on the corner of Chalmers Street. And I have an idea that through a different entity, there is another parcel as well, but I can't identify that for you immediately.
Thank you. Any more for you? Mr. Page, we should phenomenal through.
Thank you. So, for no apparent reason in terms of order, I'll ask Andy to go next, since we were talking about a traffic just a moment ago.
We were also talking about Andy going further about half an hour ago.
Well, it's a good thing you're adaptable, Mr.
Page. It is. We traffic engineers at the moment.
He gets his green light earlier than he's expected.
I've got my son this thing.
Talking about that.
give your permission, I'll skip over paragraphs 1 to 4. So, in my evidence in chief, I discussed a number of inconsistencies and difficulties in applying the notified policies associated with the proposed medium density residential MDRZ CCPO. And I note that some of these concerns have now been addressed through the proposed revisions in the council's right of reply, including removing the uncertainties around the potential to reduce car parking requirements. But my primary concern remains, and it relates to the expected outcomes if the on-site parking is required in the zone. It's common ground between Miss Banks and I that an excessive increase in traffic volumes on Brownstone Street would lead to road safety and efficiency issues arising, but we differ, however, regarding how this is influenced by the land use zone. Under the proposed zoning, parking is required in accordance with the district plan provisions. And since the area is in 31 different titles, this means that 31 separate accessways and 31 separate and potentially very small parking areas will be required and may have to be developed if individual sites are brought forward at different times. This creates multiple points of conflict between vehicles and also creates severance for pedestrians. Since on-site parking is provided, in my view, it will attract drivers to the area and it will increase traffic flows on Brownstone Street. Conversely, if the rezoning sought in the submission to Wanaka Town Centre Zone is accepted, then there would be no requirements for parking. In my view, this would lead to a reduced amount of traffic in the immediate area because of the reduced amount of parking. There would also be fewer site accesses, and so there would be less potential for conflicts between road users and less pedestrian service. Ms. Banks does not appear to consider that this zoning will reduce the traffic flows, and in addition, in her view, vehicles will park on the street instead of on site. If this outcome was to arise, though, I consider it's within the statutory powers of the council to manage. That said, I accept Ms. Banks' view that parked cars would need to be accommodated in off-site locations, but that outcome is aligned with policy 13.2.6.4, whereby off-site off-street parking is predominantly located at the periphery in order to limit the impact of vehicles. Ms. Banks also expresses reservations about the current parking policies of the council for the MDRZ. Although it's not clear what these are, and so I've not been able to respond to them. But overall, I remain of the view that the reduced level of parking enabled by rezoning the area as WTCZ will better achieve the transportation outcome than the currently proposed zone. The next section obviously moves on to submission site 2 and concerns the VA. I'm happy to run through that, or in view of your earlier comment and discussions with Mr. Page, happy to leave that for another day.
Well, I think take your cue from Mr. Page.
Well, it is evidence on which you can rely, and if you don't require Mr. Carr to read it, then we can simply table it.
Well, I think you've got to read it.
The point I made to you was about the absence of evidence.
I wouldn't want to be criticised for that.
Indeed.
So, in respect of submission site 2, my evidence in chief, I set out at this site the difference between the notified zoning, which is low density residential, and the zoning sought in the submission, which is the medium density residential, primarily relates to the potential effects on the road network. I assess this under three parts: the efficiency, road safety, and on street parking, and I showed that under each there'd be no adverse effects arising from the rezoning. And Ms. Banks does not oppose the rezoning for MDRZ as sought in the submission. With regard to the subzoning as visitor accommodation, Ms. Banks expresses concerns about the potential adverse effects on the surrounding transport network. One concern is in respect of the increase in vehicles entering and exiting the lot accesses. However, a VA subzoning would not exempt the site from having to meet the transportation-related requirements of the district plan, including the location of and site distances from vehicle crossings, both of which are tools to address any adverse effects arising from the site accesses. A further concern of Ms. Banks is the potential for adverse effects on the surrounding road network. However, in my evidence in chief, I showed that there would need to be more than 500 houses or VA units developed in the site before the capacity of the road network was exceeded. In view of the limited size of the site, in my view, the scale of development is implausibly large. I also showed that there are no underlying road safety deficiencies that will be exacerbated by increased traffic volumes.
Ms Banks also notes that no reference has been made to how parking needs would be accommodated within a VO subzoning, and notes that it should not be dependent on on-street parking spaces. The VA subzoning would not exempt the site from having to provide parking under the transportation-related requirements of the district plan. If the site was to be developed without meeting the appropriate parking requirements, then a resource consent application would be required and the effects would be assessed in a normal manner. So having reviewed Ms. Banks' rebuttal evidence, I remain of the overall views expressed in my evidence in chief, and I continue to support submission of the Arena Proprietary Limited for the rezoning of both submission sites 1 and 2 as sought. Can I answer any questions?
Thanks. I've only got questions relating to submission site 1. So starting at, no, not starting at a paragraph, so I'll do something different. Do you agree that were we to accept the client's relief, that the town centre zone would enable more floor space on that area of land than the council's median density?
Yes.
And all things being equal, would you normally expect to see more floor space resulting in more traffic generation in real terms?
In totality, yes, but not necessarily in the same location.
Yes, yes. Have you, in your work, undertaken any consideration of what that difference in floor space or generation might be?
I did some initial calculations. It's not included within my evidence that it was the early stage of the project, so I can't remember the numbers. But there is an increase in traffic generation.
Okay, I want to see that further. In terms of your paragraph 5, the potential for road safety and efficiency issues. I have wandered down Brownson Street a few times in previous years as well as for this hearing. I come from a town where arterials are often 4 or 6 lanes carrying 60,000 people today, with driveways all over the show, with 1960s and 1970s vintage houses giving existing use rights for people to reverse all over those roads to get in and out of their properties.
Yes.
And somehow the world hasn't stopped turning. Now, I'm not suggesting it's a desirable thing, but I want to understand when we're talking about road safety and efficiency issues, whether we're talking about a relativistic change from what happens to exist now, or whether we're talking about serious effects that are well beyond the reasonable design capacity of the road and or capability of council slash NZTA slash landowners to manage.
One issue with levels of service is it's perceived differently. A queue of vehicles in Invercargill means a different thing to a queue of vehicles in Queenstown or Wanaka or Auckland or Wellington. So there is an element of a relativistic type of approach. But there's a lot of modelling which is showing that Brownson Street at peak times starts to struggle in future. One of the reasons for the roundabout that was constructed at the eastern end was to try to divert more people away from Ardmore Street. And part of the council's overall vision for Wanaka at the time was to try to move traffic onto Brownson Street and away from Ardmore so that the lakefront would become more open rather than have the road running through creating disturbance. One of the downsides of that is it then starts to increase traffic volumes on Brownson Street to the extent that vehicles will potentially start to move around and find alternative routes. It won't be the end of the world if Brownson Street starts to get really busy, because if it's really busy, then people will start to park around the outside and walk in, which that's part of the town centre vision and policy. The council has always, as long as I can recall, signal that Brownson Street should become the arterial and vehicles should not be allowed to reverse on it. They've kind of shot themselves in the foot a wee bit by putting in 48 parking spaces towards the west where people have to reverse back out onto Brownson Street. This undermines that a wee bit. But while it will be busy, we're not talking of nose to tail traffic 24/7. We're talking of potentially at the busiest times of the year. It's going to become congested, but for the rest of the time, if it's not going to be operating above its reasonable operating ability.
Do you have a copy of this course in evidence handy? And if you do, could you turn to page 10?
With two copies, you can do it.
I'm interested in figure 3, which has in black text in the actual figure 3 the title sketch to it. So that's a kind of outcome that this course is suggesting would be a good thing and might happen.
Yeah.
Concrete parking on both sides, devices to narrow the carriageway, street trees, SUVs and vans, competing views, pedestrians darting out between them. I'm struggling, to be frank, to see the safety, the material safety difference between an outcome that's similar to what's being proposed here and one that might eventuate into the council's proposed zone. I'm not suggesting there isn't one, but I'm struggling to see it as anything like the magnitude that you're suggesting. It seems to me that if any promotion of growth and development on Brownson Street is enabled, it will provide A, more traffic, B, more pedestrians, equaling C, more risk of accident.
Certainly it will provide more pedestrians because the encouragement is for people to walk. The issue about more traffic, I think, goes to more of a strategic overview about what the council wants to do with Wanaka. Mm. Does it want to have lots of little car parks all over Wanaka? Or does it want to try to say, park on the outside, walk in, because actually you can walk across the whole of Wanaka in less than 5 minutes? And that's where I think there's sort of a strategic overview, if you like, from the parking point of view, which is to some extent encapsulated in Wanaka parking strategy, but doesn't necessarily fit comfortably with the MDR, where there's this requirement, and absent a resource consent, to have these multiple accesses and multiple car parks.
Yeah, well, that brings us on to your paragraph 6, because it seems, based on your answer, that for you, the issue is more about how you manage car parking than any particular medium density with an overlay or town centre with an overlay. So, for instance, if the medium density overlay was the one that was proposed to have the traffic measures you support,
yeah,
and it was a town centre zone that didn't, presumably you might prefer the medium density zone for all the reasons that you've just said about minimising accessways and minimising fragmented car parks.
That's absolutely. Yeah. I'm coming at this from a presentation.
No, it's very
perspective in that
regard. Yeah. So we get to paragraph 6. It seems to me that the nub of evidence is the extent to which the provisions proposed will reduce parking requirement and will reduce the number of vehicle crossings.
Yeah.
So if we were to find that even with the opportunity to not have a number of car parks specified in a plan, but still needing to demonstrate what the answer should be, which might still lead to car parks, do you accept that if we were to support the relief sought by your clients, there might still be 31 different titles developed differently with 31 accessways, with car parks not conforming with a set number in the plan, but determined on a case-by-case basis some might have one, some might have none, some might have 10.
And under the provisions, that is a possibility. Mm. Under the notified provisions, that's far more likely to happen because it's a requirement, my view.
Yeah, yeah. But you're aware that your relief is a requirement. It's not do what you like, it's figure it out and get a restricted discretionary resource consent.
Within the context of the policies of the town centre, yeah, which is talking about trying to move the parking towards the outside.
But they don't say the expectation is no parking. The expectation is, let's look at the actual provision. Car parking demand, access, loading and traffic generation of the Wanaka town centre transition overlay are considered in an integrated manner with the town centre zone responded to. That's from Mr. Grew's evidence at 13.4.4. That's the actual restriction of discretion. That doesn't seem to me to say there shouldn't be car parks. It just says this is an issue that has to be demonstrated on a case-by-case basis.
And compare that with policy 13.264, which talks about off-street parking being predominantly located at the periphery. So yeah, we've got the policy direction. That, so yes, it might happen there, but in practice there's the policy which is encouraging it around the outside.
And so there's your suggestion that if there's one on-street parking space and 10 people come and pick and consent, they can all say, I'll use that one on-street parking space. Or in reality, do you think there'll have to be analyses of the town centre on a case-by-case basis when applications come in? Surveys over time showing the use of on-street spaces, surveys looking at what other developments have been approved, and notwithstanding the policy direction, a possibility that people in the overlay will still be required to provide some of their parking requirement. I'm not disputing with you that there might be less, but I'm struggling to see your assertion that there will be effectively none.
I think a lot of those surveys that you talked about have already been done by the council. The land use has already been included within the WIPA model, for example. So there are tools available to the council to have a look at this. But within the scope of what's being talked about, I have no difficulty in saying that there will be some locations that might have car parking. But with a strong policy direction and a clear policy from the council of moving the car parking around to try to reduce these types of conflicts, it's going to lead to a better outcome, because there might be 31, but to my mind, having might 31 is better than will be 31. I can see that multiple access is down Branston Street. I think Mr. Banks and I are on the same page. Multiple access is down Branston Street.
I understand that. I'm still struggling a little bit, but again, you say there will be 31 access ways in the medium density zoning option. But there's nothing stopping people getting a resource consent, arguing the exact same argument you're putting forward to say why they shouldn't have one. So it seems to me that the worst case you've described for the medium density zone might not end up being that bad, and the best case you've described for your client's relief might not be that good. And I'm trying to find out what's in the middle between the two. So you're agreeing that, in any event, that there's no requirement to not provide parking proposed, there's no requirement proposed to not have accesses. It's a probability, likelihood scenario. Do you agree that muddying the water between that is that, as you agreed in the very first answer, the town centre zone would be providing for more floor space, which might be providing for more traffic generation, but then has to be figured out off-site?
More floor space would lead to more traffic generation. Mm-hmm. More traffic generation doesn't necessarily have to occur on Branston Street if it's considered in respect to the...
What you've told me is that under the medium density zoning option, there will be a much greater likelihood of vehicle access way serving sites and on-site car parking and all the effects that this course has talked about, as well as just traffic. Then you've said in the town centre zone option, even though there's no guarantee there'll be less vehicle accesses, and no guarantee there'll be less on-street car parks, on-site car parks, you're saying, based on the policy provision, there's encouragement to look off-site.
Yeah.
But what you're not really acknowledging is that by providing for more floor space in the town centre zone option, you're actually creating potentially more traffic generation per site that needs to be figured out off-site.
Yes.
So even if there is some off-site parking, because there's more parking potentially having to be dealt with, you're still creating possibly more potential to still carry a balance back on the subject site. Have I got that right?
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't say there's more. I suppose there is more potential, but there's still the policy that sits there that goes, if that potential's there, it should be considered at the time and then bumped around to the outside.
I'll rephrase it. I know you've worked around the country for a number of councils, and you've been working on a number of contexts about parking and centres, and it's fair to say it's a conundrum everywhere.
Yeah.
Is there a likelihood, in your view, of additional costs falling on the council as a consequence of a greater emphasis being shifted on council figuring out our parking problems than applicants just dealing with it on their own there?
Yeah. I think the issue at the heart of it is whether individual landowners versus the council should have the overview of where the car parking should go. If the philosophy is let the market decide and let individual landowners provide for their own needs, then the outcome is smaller car parks dotted around. If, on the other hand, the council takes a more of a stronger approach, such as potentially enabled through here, then it does enable the council to have a look at parking in strategic locations, taking into account loadings on the road network and the road safety issue. So yes, there is a cost potentially imposed on the council. There's a mechanism to recover that by greater floor areas being developed through development contributions and the like. So it can be cost neutral, with the council being a bit smart about it. But it also then means that the council has control about where the heavier loading on the road network goes and make sure that it can be accommodated, as opposed to putting traffic onto each individual site in the frontage roads where it doesn't necessarily have the same degree of control on the efficiency and the safety.
Do you think that were we to support the relief thought, including the overlay as put to us in the policy? Two related questions. The first one, would it create a regulatory situation where development within the town centre overlay, by virtue of the specific policies it would enjoy, would get first dibs on the use of public on-street parking in the case of people coming in for resource consent asking to lower their parking requirement because they want to use on-street parks around them? Because no other town centre zone would enjoy policies saying reduce parking, shift it to the public parks.
When you say no other, you're talking within the context of one choice.
So the wider town centre. So say the chairperson is not the chairperson, he owns the site, he wants to get less car parking, he goes to council with a consent application. The council says, sorry, we've effectively had to earmark public places for the town centre overlay because they've got policies saying they should get the on-street parking. Do you think that's creating a potential disadvantage or issue for other town centres like landowners or developers?
I wouldn't think so. I think that the council has then the duty to go, well, actually, we need a bit more car parking. Let's put it in the places that we'd like to see it, as opposed to letting landowners decide. Or alternatively, that landowner, if they chose to do that, could then say, well, I'm going to put my full car parking spaces plus an access onto the road and see the vehicles reverse out onto it. So there isn't necessarily a disadvantage imposed by that. I wouldn't necessarily see it as a first dibs type of thing either. I think it's a question of assessing what's there. If you're putting in a restaurant, for example, you might say, well, I generate my traffic at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. The commercial developments aren't operating then, and therefore I can make use of those spaces and multitask those spaces.
Why then should there be a policy specific to the town centre overlay talking about on-street parking if you've just said it makes no real difference between people in the town centre zone anyway, seeking a reduction in car parking? Surely there must be some benefit to the policy. Otherwise, why have it?
I would suggest that, and from my perspective, from a transportation perspective, traffic engineers as a profession are generally quite nervous, and so we'd like to have a belt and braces approach to quite a lot.
Except anyway, you're encouraging not having belt and braces provisions, so leave it to case by case resource consent, etc.
Well, as you pointed out before, the case by case resource consent is an avenue that's open anyway.
Okay. So the related question I was going to ask you was, if we were to agree, what is, in your view, the risk of everyone else in the town centre zone saying, who cares what the parking requirements are? If the people down the road or across the street can just go, I want a resource consent based on my assessment, what's to stop everyone else just saying, who cares what the rules are, let's just all apply for consent? Even though they're not in the overlay, but say clearly, if the overlay is about to look at the town centre as a whole, sounds like a great method. What's to stop everyone else?
That's the risk.
Jumping in soon.
They do that in the operative district.
Yeah, what I'm suggesting to you is, do you think that if we were to agree with the relief being sought by the submitter, it might lead to other owners in the town centre applying for resource consent more frequently rather than bothering to comply with the parking requirement at all?
I couldn't speculate on the number, but I can say that each operator works on the basis of its own commercial needs, and so there potentially will be some people that will try that. there'll be other people that will say, look, I don't actually need parking on my site and therefore I'm not going to try that. There's also a lot of instances where people look at the district plan and throw it out and say, well, the numbers aren't right anyway. Supermarkets is a good example. And because you look at it and you go, well, general retail actually doesn't really work for me as a supermarket, I'm going to put in a few more spaces.
I've had a number of experiences where the assessed traffic generation of development, let's just pick a number, say 300 spaces required, but because the district plan had a numeric requirement that was lower, say 250 spaces, an applicant's been able to say, hey, I don't need to provide my parking requirement, I only need to provide what the plan requires, 250, I'm winning. Have you had familiarity with those kind of occurrences? You've sort of applied it previously just now with your supermarket example.
Well, I've certainly been in circumstances where, you know, where the developers looked at the district plan and said the numbers are far too low there, it's not going to work for my particular developer, so I'm going to provide more parking than that.
But have you had experiences where a developer has not had to provide the number of spaces they might otherwise have had to provide because the district plan threshold gave them a lower solution?
Good question. I haven't had an experience where a developer has overtly done that.
Okay. Following on from that though, and notwithstanding likelihood and probability, and we'll juggle all those things, you've cast the relief sort as effectively 100% likely to require less parking spaces than if there was a number in the plan. And I want to test with you whether or not, in fact, there might be a probability that the relief sort, saying figure it out based on traffic assessments as part of your RDA, might actually come up with numbers that are higher than what a number in the plan might have otherwise said.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. But it then becomes where those parking spaces go.
And we don't really know that they can be all accommodated or substantially accommodated off-site. It's just a supposition, isn't it? That there's a lot around and they seem to be underused and first and best place to jump on that.
Well, if you read Mr. Banks' evidence, she's suggesting that actually the car parking spaces that are under pressure at certain times of the year, certain times of the year that they're not, but it does start to open up the avenue of being a bit smart about where those spaces are going to go, as opposed to saying, well, the traditional approach of, well, you provide your own needs, bang it on the side. It doesn't fit well, I don't think, with an approach of trying to minimise traffic flows passing through the town centre.
Yeah, but nonetheless, do you agree, whatever the probability we may end up finding it is, but do you agree that there is a possibility that were we to agree with the method sought, there might in fact be a higher parking requirement imposed on the overlay area than if there was just a number in the plan, and it might all have to be accommodated on those 31 sites in a fragmented way?
I think if there was a number, then that kind of falls into the transportation section, which isn't sorted out yet. So it's hard to say for definite what those will be and what the approach will be taken within the transportation section. And in terms of the possibility of there being 31 individual vehicle crossings, then I think it remains a remote possibility rather than a probability under the MDR.
Yep. So to wrap up, because I didn't know, especially looking at his watch, really on subject. Putting aside, let's just assume, for instance, we find scope looking at all the submissions together. If we thought this idea of trying to minimise parking and encourage better use of public parking was such a good idea it could actually apply to the whole town centre, and we made that recommendation, however, but we didn't agree with the idea of just saying figure out parking and promise later on, and at every site, let's just say we agree to zone at town centre and we say town centre is town centre. They should all have a common goal about parking, not just one little bit of it. But they should also all start from the same point of view of the parking requirement. Either they should all leave it for consent to figure it out, or they should all be subject to a number. Would that be an outcome good, consistent with your analysis and views?
Yeah, I think it would.
No
other
questions.
Question
or
answer?
No,
thank you, sir.
Just only a couple of points from me. That
talked about 31 separate access ways, 31 separate and likely very small parking areas. This is your paragraph 50.
Mm.
What's the current position? How many separate access ways are there in this area? How many separate on-site parking facilities are there?
There's quite a lot of individual access ways. I don't have an exact number. Most of that area where it has been used for the few residential properties that are left have sort of private driveways and the like. There have been a couple of sites that seem to have been consolidated in terms of their parking needs. Russell Street has got 90 degree parking further up, for example.
So does that suggest that the incremental difference of the horror story compared to the status quo may not be that great?
Hard to forecast how it would transpire depending on which parcels the land are brought forward at which time. And certainly, my scenario explicitly talks about the 31 lots being brought forward at separate times. If they were brought forward by landowners working together, then there would be scope to rationalise access to parking. But that isn't a certainty, of course, depending on the sort of extension of the willing seller, willing buyer type of argument.
And in terms of the observation that Branson's under pressure at times now, having attempted to do this myself, how much of that is because the supermarket has an entrance onto Brownston and every man and his dog wants to turn right into that entrance across the flow of traffic?
I can speak anecdotally from having tried to do the same. and what I see anecdotally happening at busy times is that people try to find a space and so they hover around the entrance on the expectation and hope that someone emerges and they can zip into the space. People don't tend to drive in all the way through to that car park as much as they could do, and as I see other viewers. So there is an element of that. The contributing percentage of that, it'll certainly be an aspect of it, but it's primarily due to the fact that there's really only two east-west routes through Wanaka, and Sarborne Street and there's Brownston Street, and the council is trying to put more traffic down Brownston Street, and one outcome of that becomes more congestion.
And in terms of the Commissioner's questions about safety of Ms. Corson's sketch as to how the street might be looked, might look under the Farina relief if granted, is that going to encourage or just discourage use of Brownston as an arterial route, east-west route?
There's no reason why a well-designed route can't accommodate through traffic. There's mechanisms that the vertical elements that are in place will encourage, for example, slower vehicle speeds through there, and the council could come to the party and reduce the speed limit more formally as they've done in Christchurch, with an anticipation of better accommodating pedestrian needs. It's an overall integrated solution, I think, that's required. And in my view, the sketch that's in Ms. Corson's evidence doesn't preclude through traffic. It doesn't necessarily result in increased road safety risk. It's all to do with the management of that as it's implemented.
I come from Wellington, where people are getting bowled by buses all the time. In central Wellington,
there's no buses in Wanaka, for example.
So I've got to observe that at least we don't have that problem, and in particular don't have silent trolley buses.
Yes.
That people step out and then look and find it's a bit late. But in terms of encouraging pedestrian movement between the two sides of the road, is that going to pose problems again for arterial, for both the safety of pedestrians and for arterial movement of vehicles?
Well, again, if you have it as a free-for-all, it might, but through good design, it won't. Going back a few years now, but I changed 22 in Christchurch, and the Stick Centre deliberately had a main street going through the middle of it, and for that very reason. Looking at a job that I did in the Holeswell, had a main street running through the middle of a retail area. Again, that was to do with urban design issues and vibrancy, but was managed in a manner which meant that pedestrians could easily cross from side to side and vehicles had to give way. And that was done by slow vehicle speeds and traffic engineering measures. So it doesn't, the layout doesn't, as I say, require an increase in pedestrian risk, but it could do if it wasn't done well.
After the morning tea break, but I think that's a whole thesis, as I perceive it, that it needs to be done well. So we'll take that as a given. Any final questions? Well, on that happy note, we'll adjourn and be back at 20 to 12.